Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up on today's show, Lawrence Donegan is a renowned Scottish journalist and author and former musician with bands such as Lloyd Cole and The Commotions. He's now based in the US and he's back on the US election beat for what he says is the biggest story of our lifetime. He's been travelling all around America covering the US presidential campaign, and he's going to be joining me later to give us his take on where things stand in the race for the White House. And as the big beasts of Wall Street are no longer having it all their own way, a new wave of electronic trading firms muscle in on their patch. So we're going to be looking in at the companies who are taking over the global stock market landscape. And finally, in the budget this week, fuel prices went up, but that's not the only concern for households and car owners as tensions escalate in the Middle East. We're going to look at the potential cause for concern about yet another energy crisis and cost of living crisis that might be attached to it. I'll be joined by Muireann Lynch of the ERSI, and Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times is going to be giving us his take on Budget 2025. You can email us, at, as always, at takingstock@newstalk.com, and we're also open on Twitter at StockNT.
At Coral, I believe Budget 2025 provides the ways and means for continuing to deliver many more bright and hopeful days for us all. All this and more can be achieved because of the decisions we are taking today for our people, our communities and our country. Talanvidum agum asarnina agasas cominatir evad niasmo of wintimach. Togan bushaid fihafir kuig on bonus e shoyenov. I commend the budget to the House.
So first up today, we're going to look at Budget 2025. There's been cuts to taxes, one-off payments and other additional spending. And we saw a 10.5 billion election giveaway spending spree targeted at putting money back in people's pockets. There was also an increase, though, in tax on the likes of petrol and diesel, with absolutely nothing for hospitality. And the 13.5% VAT rate wasn't touched, which is making a lot of people around the country very unhappy. Well, joining me now to discuss is Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times and Muireann Lynch, Senior Research Officer at the ESRI. Cliff and Muireann, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining me today. Now, Cliff, I'm going to kick off with you because you were writing about the budget in very harsh terms, saying very clearly that the priority for the budget 2025 is getting this coalition government re-elected. Maybe talk us through why, if you need to, that's your opinion.
Yeah, well, I suppose we had thought that the budgets were going to start reducing in size a bit, and the cost of living crisis started to ease, but I suppose with a big surplus available and a general election coming up, maybe it was inevitable there was going to be another big giveaway. I suppose there were a couple of different bits to the budget. One was a normal kind of budgetary fare of tax and welfare changes that are going to come in next year, which in the round were, you know, roughly what might be expected, I suppose. One thing to note is that government spending overall is continuing to increase very quickly. Particularly as the base this year is going to increase as well, and there'll be another increase on top of that next year. Second bit of the budget was this kind of, were these commitments, I suppose you'd say, to massive amounts of additional capital spending in the years ahead. So an additional $3 billion to come from selling the state's shares in AIB. The famous money from Apple, which wasn't allocated in detail, but indications were given that it was going in the same direction. But it's a massive commitment to investment, which the country needs. But I suppose little enough indication of how they are going to be achieved or how things are going to be changed to get things to happen a bit more quickly. Perhaps that's not a thing for budget anyway.
Yeah.
The final bit, I suppose, was the what were the headlines about the once-off giveaways. I have to say, I'm not a great fan of those. They'll be welcoming a lot of households, of course, and particularly less well-off households, although they're not really a strategy for helping those people in the longer term. And they're also going to give a lot of money, I think, to people who don't frankly need it, the universal payments. You know, did we really need another round of energy credits to be paid to everybody? Is it really a good idea to be paying double child benefit before Christmas? And I suppose if there was one clear measure that suggested an election was coming, it's double child benefits in November and December for all families.
And look, that overarching view of the budget in its totality is what a body like IFAC, or the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, who was set up in the wake of what happened in 2008 to kind of keep a check on these things. They're very unhappy about this budget. Tell us why you think that is and what they've been saying.
Yeah, I suppose they went up in football terms with their studs up. And they've been doing that, in fairness, for the last couple of years. They're just unhappy in general with the trend in government spending. They're pointing out that, look, the government committed to a 5% limit on spending each year, permanent spending increases, and that, you know, ever since that limit has been was imposed, it's pretty much been broken every year. And they say, look, this is going to be inflationary, it's going to add to prices, and it risks, as they say, repeating the mistakes of the past when we spent a lot of money when we had it and ended up in a boom to bust cycle. The government's case is that, look, the population has grown much more quickly than had been expected. This has put pressure on government services. It's put pressure on education, health, and it's also, of course, as we discussed before, put huge pressure on for investment in infrastructure, in housing, water and energy, which is well behind, all well behind where it's needed.
Mm.
So that's the argument, if you like. I suppose you would have to think that in a few budgets' time, unless corporation tax keeps surging ahead, whoever's in government is going to be faced with tighter decisions, tougher decisions, trade-offs, which are much more difficult than they are at the moment.
Mm. And we've heard from Pascal Donoghue and Jack Chambers, indeed, ahead of the budget, saying that inflation was coming down, and because of that, you might not want to, you would not maybe expect what you got previously. But like they, across Europe, I suppose, as well, they've done a good job in difficult circumstances through various different measures of getting that inflation rate down. Could this be an inflationary budget?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was certainly the case that IFAC were making, and they were saying, look, if you look over the last 3 years, the excess in spending over what's planned is adding a fair bit to inflation and costing families money. I think if you look at the injection of money, a lot of it's going to come this year. So there's going to be a big boost to spending in the run-up to Christmas.
Mm.
I think there's no doubt about that. Families are going to have a lot more money in their pocket. Is that going to add to prices? I mean, in fairness, the evidence of the last few years is that inflation has come down, notwithstanding that. We're very much dependent on external factors in terms of overall inflation, particularly energy prices.
Mm.
But nonetheless, you know, there's going to be more money being spent, and I think certainly in the run-up to Christmas, tills are going to be ringing, and prices in some areas are going to be edged upwards.
Yeah. Cliff, you might stay with us. I'll come back to you on that energy price issue toward the end. I'm joined now on the line also by Muireann Lynch, who's a Senior Research Officer in the Economic Analysis Division of the ESRI. Muireann, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Muireann, I just wanted to get your take on the budget. We wanted to look at fuel in particular and the costs that are increasing and the measure that are brought in this budget in particular. One of the things that we noticed was the rate of carbon tax levied on fossil fuels will increase by €7.50. What does that actually mean in layman's terms when you're talking about people's bills?
Yeah, so if you remember kind of back in the day, it was usually excise duty on petrol and diesel was increased always the night of the budget. And excise duty hasn't really been touched now for a while. But what the government is doing instead is increasing the carbon tax by €7.50 per ton every year. And the idea is to do this out until 2030, when it'll hit €100 per ton. And that's the path that they've been following. Now, this obviously adds onto petrol and diesel, a couple of cents on the litre. Now, the majority of the money that the government takes when you fill up your car with petrol or diesel is actually through VAT and excise, because there's still a significant excise. The carbon tax is still a smallish component, but the majority of the money that you pay at the pump goes to the government through those three forms of tax. There's VAT, there's excise, and there's carbon tax. I suppose the difference between carbon tax and excise duty is carbon tax also applies to home heating oil and to gas. But what the government has announced is that they're going to keep the lower VAT rate on electricity and gas, which was introduced in and around the Ukrainian crisis. So the idea is to And that should offset the increase in carbon tax a little bit. And then the increases in carbon tax have also been delayed in the last few budgets. They haven't come in the very next day. And they've kind of pushed them out till the following summer.
Mm. You mentioned the excise duty, the VAT, and now the carbon tax on fuels. It's a huge revenue raiser for government every year. And the same can be said of VRT. So if you're pushing people more and more toward electric vehicles and all of that, you're depleting that fund. What was done around this area, or how would they compensate for that?
Yeah, it's a big problem. Like the policy is that we're supposed to be switching to a huge number of electric cars, and then we're also looking to increase active modes of transport like walking and cycling and all that kind of thing. And those are all great from a climate perspective. But the problem is that electric cars obviously don't use any petrol or diesel, and they also have much lower rates of VRT. And at the moment, through all of those different measures, the government raises about $5 billion from motorists. Now, if we all do what we want everyone to do, which is stop using fossil fuels to get around the place, switch to electric cars, that's fantastic. But it means now suddenly we're $5 billion short that we need to raise from elsewhere.
Mm.
So this is the long-run problem that we're seeing. And there are different ways around it. One suggestion is you could move toward pricing congestion or road charging. So we're still charging people, we're still charging motorists to get around the place, but instead of doing it via the fuel and via the cars, we're doing it via how much they use the road and when and where they use the road.
Yeah, well, whatever about giving bonanza cost of living packages, I can tell you one thing, they weren't going to have a discussion about introducing a congestion charge on the eve of an election campaign for sure. But maybe in the next government they will look at that. I do think it's a very serious issue for the future in terms of the concerns that they have about the VAT issue, for example. You know, they say that raises 800 million per year, but this could be something that is affecting the exchequer every single year as we go forward. Mirren, just to pivot slightly before I let both of you go, I wanted to try and get your assessment in particular about how fuel prices might be affected in the coming weeks and months ahead on the basis of what's happening now and how the conflict has arisen in the Middle East. Are you seeing any changes there that we should be worried about? And, you know, when they give those cost of living packages for the winter, is there any kind of danger that they might be eaten up by volatility in the energy sector?
Yeah, so conflict in the Middle East always spells trouble for oil prices, right? I'd say a number of things. First of all, the Ukrainian crisis actually caused governments, not the Irish government, but other countries around the world, to diversify their gas supplies and also other fossil fuel supplies. So what that means is when you're kind of less reliant on all of your fossil fuel coming from one place, then shocks like conflict don't have as much of an impact on the price. However, it is the case that oil futures have started to go up because some people are thinking that oil production facilities may become an actual target, a military target. So it's certainly the case that, you know, whenever there's conflict in these areas, it's never good news. At the moment, things are going up a bit. We haven't seen massive spikes like we saw in gas prices after Russia, but it's early days.
Cliff, I'll just bring you back in here on that one, if I can. I know you have a big bugbear with these once-off measures because you think people start factoring them in. What have government potentially left for the next government coming in? It could be themselves, of course, returning, but there's a lot of expectation built up for whoever picks up the baton from this lot.
There is, yeah. I mean, just looking at the Department of Finance forecasts, and they are still predicting significant exchequer surpluses going out over the next few years. But in some ways, the numbers are getting a bit tighter too. And one of the reasons for that is this commitment to put money into two long-term funds, which is going to amount to about 6 billion euro a year. Now, that's in legislation at the moment. But of course, it's open to any future government to change that, to decide, look, we need to spend the money now. We want to put less money in and to vote that through the Dáil. So, you know, it is that will be one to watch, I think, in the early term of the next government, particularly if the huge surge in corporation tax that we've seen starts to ease off. And that really is the imponderable, more than double now what it was in 2019, just before the pandemic, an extraordinary boon to the exchequer. and the government is pretty much forecasting it's going to continue over the next few years, albeit at a much slower rate. But really, nobody has a clue. And that's really the great swing factor, I think, looking out over the next few years.
Yes, well, we'll have to guess our crystal ball out to see what will happen then. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Muireann Lynch, Senior Research Officer in the Economic Analysis Division of the ESRI, and Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times. Thank you both very much for joining me today. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Now, the old wolves of Wall Street are not having it all their own way anymore as a new batch of electronic traders seem set to take over global stock markets. Join us for all that after this short break. You welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, there was a time when firms like Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs ruled Wall Street. But perhaps these big firms didn't really appreciate how electronic markets would eventually come to challenge their dominance in global trading. Well, a legion of electronic traders have now taken over that space. And here to tell us how that is affecting the global trading landscape is Kostas Morcelas, who is the Financial Times hedge fund correspondent. Kostas, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Mandy.
Now, just these companies that we're talking about, and we'll get into the value of them and how much they have. Who exactly are they? And when did this type of electronic company start trading in this way?
So what makes the sector unique is these aren't publicly traded companies like the sort of the investment banks that we're all thinking about and you just mentioned. These tend to be private companies, privately held by a single partner or multiple partners. And they're set up explicitly with the goal of trading and making money doing so. And they generally, a lot of the most successful ones are set up at the sort of turn of the millennium, just before the year 2000 and just after. During the sort of period when your listeners might be sort of aware of the different movies that you have, so the traders on the floor and they're all shouting at each other orders and they're making hand signals. It was around that time that was still the key way that trading was happening. But slowly, things were going electronic and it was all screens replacing these big rooms of shouting traders. That's when they got their start.
And are these the companies who kind of got in ahead of the pack and have grown since that time? So who are they?
So there's a number of different ones. So perhaps the best known one is Citadel Securities, which is owned by American billionaire Ken Griffin. And they handle, I mean, an enormous amount of trading activity, $455 billion worth of trades every single day. That's a quarter of all U.S. stock trading. Then you have Jane Street, for instance, which they say that they handle around 2% of all trading in over 20 countries. These are two of the biggest firms, but you have other ones like Susquehanna. You have in Amsterdam some big players like Optiver, Flow Traders, IMC. So it's quite a global phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I was so taken aback with the figures, in particular that Citadel figure. Again, it's worth repeating. It's $455 billion per day. So when you're looking at a figure like that, can you even compare that to something like the Morgan Stanleys or the Goldman Sachs and what they might be doing in any given day?
So look, they're doing a lot as well. They still do a lot of trading. But what makes the banks of the world still have an edge in some areas around the trading ecosystem is that they do a lot of other activity which these guys don't.
Right.
They lend a ton of money to hedge funds and these firms. So rather than doing a lot of the trading themselves, they let these market makers do the trading and they'll lend to them or they provide other services.
And Kostas, why did the established banks or the companies that we spoke of earlier, why did they allow these tech kind of electronic companies to grow as big as they have?
I think it's a combination of reasons. I think a very big reason was in 2008, obviously, we had a huge global crash and regulators around the world clamped down on the banks. They instituted a lot of regulations to curb risk taking and to stop big blow-ups from happening again. But as part of that, it made trading activity in the banks a lot more costly. Mm. And banks had to be far more strategic about the types of trades they wanted to do and what businesses they wanted to expand. And the electronic trading firms, these market makers, they took the opportunity, they invested billions of dollars over several years, and now the incredible technology they have, they can buy and sell equities, bonds, you name it, in microseconds. So it's just it's a technology gap. And when we're speaking to different bankers anonymously for this story, they privately acknowledge that it would take years and years of investment to catch up with some of these firms. And by the time they've caught up, these firms are probably already invested, you know, hundreds of millions and are probably ahead.
Mm. And you mentioned regulation there in relation to the standard banks, and also how in the wake of the crash, there was an awful lot more regulations and burden put on banks to safeguard them against the liquidity crisis that they had in 2008. What is the regulatory piece like for these electronic firms? Is it the same, or do they operate on an entirely different system?
So they are far less regulated. The logic for that is that because they don't take deposits like the banks, the regulators don't really have that as much of a say as to what they should be doing. Because if they go down, in theory, they should not be bailed out, right? They just lose the money and that's it.
So if there was a liquidity crisis in, well, not liquidity, but if there was a run on these type of, are they underwritten by anyone, or who would step up to the plate in the way that governments did in the crash in 2008?
Well, in theory, governments shouldn't do that. But other parts of the market would feel that impact. Mm. So, for instance, you know, if you have one of these big firms which is trading bonds, and then all of a sudden they collapse, suddenly you have a huge trader in bonds that are no longer offering those services. So the rest of the market might panic, or there might be a liquidity crisis on the markets where these instruments are much more difficult to transact, and that can lead to a crisis in confidence in the market. There might also be losses at the banks, because the banks do underwrite a lot of these trades, because they facilitate them through sort of the back end and operations and things like that.
Mm. Very interesting. Yeah. So if we look at the differential here, it's about big technology gaps between the electronic operators and maybe the more traditional. So they were ahead of the curve on that. And they're less regulated. What about their business model in terms of costs, and how do they kind of structure themselves compared to, say, the Morgan Stanleys of this world?
So what they really specialize in is basically the buying and selling of securities like bonds and equities very, very quickly. And this is a business where you don't make a lot of money per trade. It's more about extracting sort of pennies for each trade.
But you do lots of trades then.
But you do lots and lots of trades, and that adds up. That adds up very, very quickly. Hmm. So that's what makes them different from the banks. The banks do a little bit of this trading as well, but the banks make a lot of their money from, you know, activity with fatter profit margins, like, for instance, advising a company that wants to go IPO or advising a company that wants to buy another one.
The other way, I suppose, we might look at any difference between, say, a normal trading company and this one is, what about the performance of staff and employees? I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, the way we think of Wall Street is those traders screaming across the floor in Wall Street, the movie, or even The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio. But what about those guys who are sitting behind a computer? Are they like those kind of aggressive types you see? Or really, are we talking about techno nerds who are sitting behind a desk all day?
No, it's funny. If you look at the websites for a lot of these trading firms, a lot of it is boasting about the amount of PhDs they have on staff, or the amount of engineers, or, you know, sort of mathematical experts. It's a completely different culture. Mm. And what's interesting about that as well is it is incredibly well remunerated. So one of the stats that we sort of picked up in the story was that, you know, sort of the average pay at Goldman Sachs would be $340,000, but at Jane Street, it's almost triple that, at $900,000. Wow. So it's a very different culture, much more focused on smarts and programming and coming up with these very sophisticated trading algorithms, but incredibly well remunerated.
I'm imagining that cybersecurity, data retention, all that must be a huge issue in this industry.
Absolutely. I mean, cybersecurity and just in general, operational failures can be a big problem. And sort of one of the examples that we saw was in 2014 with the sort of collapse of the trading firm Knight Capital. And it was that sort of incident where they had a rogue algorithm, basically, and they bought a ton of equities on the US market, and they very quickly lost almost $500 million and they went under. And I think that's one of the concerns that regulators have expressed, but also privately other people in the markets, that if there's some sort of operational failure or something goes wrong or something isn't tested properly, one of these algorithms could very quickly cause a crash in the market. Mm. So that's one of the things that people are watching out for very, very closely.
Mm. Now, you mentioned an article that you've recently written for the Financial Times. And in that article, you talk about some people who you spoke to citing these trading companies as maybe perhaps being better stewards of the market than the banks that came before them. Well, why do they say that?
Well, if you think about it from one perspective, this is their capital. So the founders, they've put in the capital, and all the money that they gain or lose is theirs. So you can make an argument that they keenly feel losses, and they want to make absolutely sure that they're not losing any money and that the risks they take are very careful. And indeed, one of the bankers that I spoke for this piece anonymously, he said that some of the risk management practices at these firms was far more sophisticated than at the banks.
Mm.
So there is an argument to be made that, if it's not other people's money and it's your own money, perhaps you feel losses a lot more keenly. But there are also counter arguments to that as well.
Mm. The product on offering from them, as we spoke of earlier, is largely trading. They don't take any deposits as such. But do you have you detected any kind of diversification in the product offering from any of those big top five companies? Are there plans to grow their business?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do is grow into areas which traditionally have been the kingdoms of the banks.
Mm.
So, for instance, bond trading, like corporate bonds, a lot of this market has been done not as electronically as the equities market. It's something that the banks have controlled for many years. It's the same thing with the foreign exchange market. The banks have sort of kept that market and controlled it for quite a while. So they're trying to break into these other areas which are traditionally controlled by the banks and which have been less easy to electronify. Bonds are a lot more complicated than stocks, for instance, because you have lots of different types of bonds. They're issued on different years. They might have different coupons. It's just more complicated to electronify these markets. And with FX as well, it's just traditionally, it's been a market that's very bespoke and it's for customized sort of solutions for big corporate clients, for instance.
Mm. I keep coming back to Wall Street because we tend to think of this as a global kind of industry that's physically based there. What about these companies? Are they international? Are they based in a particular area?
So they tend to be based in the United States, the biggest ones. Chicago, as we mentioned in the article, has a lot of the firms were founded there, and that's because there was a very strong trading, and there still is a very strong trading culture there. You have a lot of sort of commodities trading, derivatives trading is all concentrated around Chicago. New York obviously has a number of trading floors, including sort of equities, New York Stock Exchange. So you have a number of firms that were founded there. But Amsterdam has also had traditionally a very strong sort of trading culture. So these are sort of the big hubs, New York, Chicago, and Amsterdam. These are where a lot of these firms were founded, although increasingly, London has also had a few famous players and they're starting to spread out.
Mm. So Costas, just before I let you go, do you see that there's a tipping point maybe coming for this? Would they become more dominant than the likes of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan at some point?
It's possible, but I think it's difficult because the Morgan Stanleys, the JP Morgans of the world, they have very, very big businesses and they have big clients and they service those clients across a number of areas. And that is the one big disadvantage that these trading firms have. So, with a Morgan Stanley or a JP Morgan, They're providing services, like I mentioned earlier. They'll help a corporate client to buy another company. They'll help a client IPO. They will help a big corporate client with sort of the risks of their foreign exchange income in different countries. They have this huge, they lend to hedge funds and to these firms. They have so many different services in so many different markets that they do maintain that sort of relationship advantage, and they have these very, very big clients. And that is something that's quite difficult to overcome.
Mm.
So while these players can get bigger and bigger in trading, as they try to expand into different areas, that is where they might have a hurdle, getting over sort of these big relationships that these firms have.
Wolf of Wall Street is around for a little bit longer. Costas, thank you very much for being with us today. That was Costas Morales, the FT's hedge fund correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is News Talk's Taking Stock after the break. Renowned journalist, author, musician and sometimes writer for the Tyrconnell Tribune, Lawrence Donegan, joins me from his US road trip where he's covering the presidential race. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now for our final item today, for the golfers of you out there, you might know my next guest from his work in the Guardian newspaper or even from his famous book on golf, Four Iron in the Soul. You might also know him from his hilarious book, No News at Throat Lake. It's about his time spent in Creaslock in Donegal writing for the Tyrconnell Tribune. And a fun fact for all you 80s kids out there, he was also one of the commotions behind Lloyd Cole. But he's here today to talk about his epic voyage across the US heartlands ahead of the US presidential election. Lawrence Donegan, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Great to be on, Mandy. Thanks for having me.
Now, Lawrence, you seem like a man of very sound mind with lots of irons in the fire, lots of things to do. So tell us about this trip that you're on and what made you decide to cover the US presidential election in this way.
Well, firstly, a newspaper asked me to, but I've lived in the States for 14 years now. And I live in Northern California, Mandy, and it's quite nice where I live. It's, pretty well to do. And, everybody's, it's a nice spot and all that. And everybody votes Democrat and we're all behind Kamala Harris. But, you see these polls and you kind of follow the news, and there's just an America out there that people like me don't know. There are people out there, where I live, I probably can count on the fingers of an oven glove how many Trump supporters I know. So, the offer of going out and covering the election and this notion that I really have no idea. I thought I knew America and I thought I knew Americans, but really I don't, because I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan right now, one of the swingiest of swing states. And I walk down into the coffee shop today and there'll be two people sitting there and one of them will be voting for Donald Trump. That's a statistical fact. And I don't know that person. I don't know what motivates that person. The whole idea of the journey, I'm heading from the Golden Gate Bridge to Mar-a-Lago on election night. And the whole idea of the journey is to discover an America I didn't know and Americans that I didn't know.
Mm. Yeah, you're so right. It actually reminds me a lot of the 2016 campaign, when there was this sort of like willful blindness in the media and a bit in the commentariat, especially sort of by the time it gets here to Ireland. You sort of think, oh, sense will prevail, Trump won't get back in. But then when you start, I suppose, doing what you're doing and going down into the towns and counties and looking at what the people are saying, you probably get a real sense of who those people are who are still voting for Trump since 2016. So tell us the type of states that you've been in and what you've kind of found so far.
Well, I thought you would ask me this. I've done 16 states so far in 4 weeks.
Wow.
The vast majority of them have been Republican states, because that's the nature of the geography, the electoral geography of the United States. Most of these heartland states, you would call them, western heartland states, Montana, Idaho, Nebraska, Wyoming, on and on. Most of these states are, Republican strongholds. So the very nature of the journey, most of the states I've been, Republican states. And when I set off, Mandy, like any other kind of liberal, I don't want to call myself elite, but you know what I mean. Like anybody, you kind of set off and you think, well, these people must be, and you see it reflected in the media. You see it especially reflected in European media, and you can see it in social media. There's a great group of comedians called the Good Liars who go around to Trump rallies and interview Trump people, and and make fools of them, portray them as stupid. But once you get out on the street and get out on the road and start talking to them, they're just not normal people like you or I or my brother who lives back in Scotland and fixes buses for a living. What you discover is they're not really au fait with Trump's policy, but they don't have a full grasp on what Trump actually wants to do once he sees his power. But it is really about their identity and what they feel. And you have a vast swathe of America in these heartland states who feel dispossessed. They feel that they've lost their kind of identity. And most of all, they feel mocked and abused and made to feel stupid by the quote-unquote elites. Mm. And, when you get out here, that feels like a very valid feeling. And, I mean, I spent 5 hours waiting in line to get into a Donald Trump rally in Tucson. Honestly, Mandy, it was 105 degrees. And everybody stood for 5 hours. So I was spent 5 hours chatting to, I can still remember their names, Abby, Natalie, and Joe. Mm. And we just chatted. And my goodness, they were great people. Mm. And, we completely disagree politically, but I got a sense of where they're coming from. And, you push back on, say, Donald Trump, he's a brilliant businessman and he'll solve the economy. And you go, well, hang on a minute. He's been bankrupted 3 times. Yeah, but, so, it's easy to mock them from that perspective. However, again, it's about identity. It's not particularly about politics. Mm. And Trump, I mean, the genius of Trump, he is just an awful person, an evil man, cynical to his very core. However, he has his genius, quote unquote, genius is that he has recognized that and he is utilizing it. And I tell you what, I don't know what the feeling is back in Ireland, but this is going to be close. Mm. This is going to be close because you have, not to get too technical. I mean, you obviously understand this about the kind of game, not the game, but the mechanics of politics. So you have this incredibly well organized, hugely financed Democrat machine. I think it's the most. I think they've raised $1.5 billion in the last 6 weeks. So it's like, once the Kamala Harris campaign started, since then they have raised $1.3 billion. And when you get out on the ground, you can sense it. You can see it. Hmm. They're so well staffed. The volunteer armies are there. They're out in the streets. They're knocking doors. And on the other hand, there is nothing. I'm working on a project just now on the Republican ground game. There is nothing. I visited 6 Republican local county Republican headquarters who are meant to be at the forefront of the turnout operation, and there is nobody there. So it's going to be interesting to see how it kind of works out over the next month.
I'm just curious about one thing. You mentioned that you've attended the MAGA rallies, and we saw in that debate between Kamala Harris and former President Trump that Kamala Harris drove him absolutely mad when she said that people were leaving from exhaustion and boredom.
Yes.
What is it like to actually attend a rally like that? Are people actually leaving? And actually, how do you get into a rally like that? Is there much security? Do you have to sign up to be a member? What's all that like?
Well, it's exhausting and boring. That's a straight answer. Actually, I did a piece about this. I went to a Trump rally in Las Vegas. I've been to a few.
I know you did. That's why I'm asking.
And I did. I didn't listen to him. I went and stood at the exit door all night. And it's true.
But you did. You did watch the people leaving.
And that's what I did because that's how I roll, Mandy. It's true. People started leaving after 2 or 3 minutes. You have. I mean, it's interesting. It's not people are exhausted and bored. Some of them are, clearly. But, people go for the history. Mm. I spoke to a guy who brought his 2 kids at the rally in Vegas. He brought his 2 kids. And, he says that's one of the beauties of living in a swing state like Nevada. All the candidates come through here. And, my kids get to see history. At least we can say we saw him. And they left after 2 minutes. But it really does eventually. He's 78 years old at this stage. He doesn't really have that much to say. It's just a selection of vignettes, and they've all been honed and and, you know, ground down into this. You know, you've seen them a million times. But again, it is. It's pretty, I don't want to use the word cool in the context of Donald Trump, but it is, you do, when you're there, you do sense that you are seeing something historic. Mm-hmm. You and I are both journalists. So we've gone through our careers, and, you know, I could reel off a few of very, very historic things I've been at. If you go to a Trump rally, it is, you know, quite historic. For instance, on Saturday, I'll be going to, he's going back to Butler, Pennsylvania, where he was shot. Of course, he said he would never talk about the assassination attempt again, because he talks about it every day now, and he's now going back to the site of it. So I'll be going to that, and that's, you know, that's that's something I'll, you know, tell my grandkids or whatever, that I was there. But the rallies, so yes, the question about the rallies themselves are, they are pretty, you know, you go to a Harris rally or a Waltz rally, my goodness, the energy, the excitement, it can fool you into thinking, oh, this race is over. And meanwhile, you go to a Trump rally, it's, you know, people are pretty enthusiastic for a time, but he goes on and on.
Yeah,
and on.
It sounds like it's pretty turgid stuff. Now, this week we got to see Vance versus Walz in the vice presidential debate on TV. You got to see him in the flesh at the Berlin Raceway in Ottawa County, Michigan, no less. Yeah. And you compared, you said he's like a NASCAR trying to pass himself off as a fairground dodgem. What's he like in a crowd like that? And beyond him trying not to irk the ire of Donald Trump, what's the end game for Vance in all of this?
Well, yeah, that's a brutal, that's a really, to me, that's such an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, he's a thoroughbred. In terms of a political performer, he's a Yale law graduate. He's super impressive, speaks unbelievably well without notes, answers journalists' questions, bats them away like Babe Ruth, you know, a softball. He's a brilliant political operator, performer rather. And do you know what? The interesting thing about Vance, he can intellectualize a Trump philosophy, if there is such a thing. Whereas Trump doesn't have the concentration or the stamina to actually implement the things he says. But Vance, you know, if you're inclined my way, Vance is pretty scary, because he will do it, and he will believe it, and he will sell it. The scary thing for me, you can see him evolving in front of our very eyes. You know, a month ago, it was all, you know, childless cat ladies and all terrible stuff. And it's still terrible stuff, but he's really honed his act. And yesterday was very, very impressive. Of course, the guy's standing there in his $10,000 suit and his, you know, Brooks Brothers loafers, you know, telling the crowd in front of him who are wearing their $10 MAGA hats that he's just like them. Well, he's really not. He's funded by tech billionaires like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. He is nothing like these people, but he can pretend that he is, and he does it very, very impressively. I suspect that he doesn't care either way if they win this time. He probably wants to win, but he wouldn't mind if they lost, because he is kind of proven his chops. Trump has already said he won't run again in 2028. So I think this run has put Vance in pole position to take over. And if that happens, then he is a very scary prospect.
Yeah, interesting to see the way he's evolving as the campaign goes on and becoming more sort of moderate, if that's the right word for him, if you can use that in relation to any of these. So just two final things I wanted to check with you. First of all, the opinion polls. I mean, we're absolutely overrun with them here. I can't keep up with them anymore. Yes. Where on earth do they have both candidates at the moment? And can we believe them? You're writing on Substack, I think it is, every couple of days, an article called Goodbye Donald. And that's really the question, I suppose, I wanted to ask you, is do you think the polls are pointing that way, and do you concur?
The polls have Harris in the national polls. There's two sets of polls. There's national polls and the state polls. The national polls have her maybe between 2.5-3 percentage points ahead, which on the face of it is pretty good. But again, there's the weird way that America chooses its president through this electoral college system, means that she really has to win by at least the national vote by 2% to have a chance of winning the electoral college vote, i.e. the swing states. The swing states are a little bit tighter than the national polls, but again, they still have her up slightly. But, I mean, do I believe the polls? Probably, yeah. But I think, the polls, are, again, famously, 2016, you mentioned it earlier, the polls had Clinton ahead of Trump on election day. And again, they had Biden ahead of Trump on election day 2020. And both times, the Trump's share of the vote was much higher than was polled. It'd be interesting to see if the polls have got better and they detect these so-called hidden Trump voters. And if they have, then the polls are right. If they haven't, then stand by for a long, not just a night on November the 5th, but a long week. It could go all the way to Saturday like it did in 2020.
Look, at the end of the day, this is all going to be decided by a relatively small number of people in a small number of crucial key states, as you mentioned there. And it's ironic, we're having this global debate about how they're doing, but that's what it will come down to, who can target those the best. Before I let you go, what has been the most surreal moment in your journey so far?
Well, it's actually happening today, Mandy.
I hope it's not this interview.
Unless I'm about to appear on my first MAGA podcast.
Wow.
I ran into a guy yesterday at the JD Vance rally, and he was interviewing people, and we got talking. I'm quite good at talking to people, Mandy. So we agreed that I could interview him for 20 minutes as long as I came on his 2-hour MAGA podcast. So that will be pretty surreal for me, because I'm not sure he and I will have much to agree upon.
Well, it definitely might be worth tuning into. Lawrence, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. And that Substack account, again, it's called Goodbye Donald. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's very funny, very informative and scary in equal measure. That was Lawrence Donegan, author and journalist. Thank you very much for being with us today.
All the best. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks to all of today's guests. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy, Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, you can email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. So from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And we're going to leave you today with Lloyd Cole and The Commotions and Lauren Stonigan. Took a last weekend in a hotel Amsterdam, a double pneumonia in a single room, and the sickest joke was the price of the medicine. Don't they laughing at me now? May I please laugh along with you? This morning I woke up from a deep, a quiet sleep with ashtray clothes.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston. Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.